Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Mark Buchfuhrer, who will be telling us a little bit about restless leg syndrome. So tell me a little bit about the RLS Foundation.
Okay, the RLS Foundation is a nonprofit foundation that was founded, I believe, in 1992. It was founded by a group of RLS patients who thought that RLS, being a very common disease but kind of underdiagnosed and not well understood, really needed an advocacy. So it again, it's progressed over the years, and now it's a very dynamic organization that sponsors research. It has support groups. I think there's 80 or more support groups throughout the United States and Canada. It has resources and information on its website. And it publishes a quarterly newsletter called Nightwalkers that has a lot of information. And it also sponsors and vets quality centers for restless legs, of which there are, unfortunately, only 11 around the world.
So
and it also does political advocacy where, again, RLS... and need, it's often not taken that seriously, and it doesn't get a lot of NIH funding for grants, and there's issues with some of the medications that are used for restless legs for example, on real severe cases, we often have to use opioid therapy, and as you know, we have an opioid epidemic crisis in this country, so it's getting harder and harder to, for patients with opioids, and this may affect the RLS population. So the foundation has been actually advocating on Capitol Hill to try to get a little more understanding for this subgroup population of patients.
So when it comes to RLS, what are some of the myths concerning how it can affect a person?
Well, RLS is, often very misunderstood. And it's like any other disorder. If you have some mild back pain occasionally, but if you have severe back pain and have 4 or 5 operations, it can be debilitating. So, the same is for legs. Of the 10% of the adult population that has restless legs, a third have it mild. It's not really a big deal for those people. A third have it basically, moderate, and maybe sometimes bothersome enough. Sometimes they can, they can live with it. They may not need medication. But a third, roughly about 2 or 3% of the total adult population, has it severe enough that it can be very debilitating. Now, to give you an idea of what severe restless legs can be like, first of all, imagine what happens if, let's say, you're in a hotel room and there's loud noise and you can't sleep most or all the night. Well, you can at least lie in bed, read, watch TV, relax. But an RLS patient, when the RLS is not being controlled, can't even sit or lie down and relax. They have to keep walking. So just imagine every night you may have to keep walking for several hours. And if you're lucky, you might get 1, 2, or 3 hours of sleep before you have to get up. And again, different than the analogy of the hotel room where you might be there a night or two, just imagine this occurring every night. So you can imagine the severe sleep deprivation you can get. Furthermore, the patients with severe restless legs may even have it start in the morning. Typically, restless legs starts in the evening or bedtime, but as it gets severe, it can be 24/7. So I have patients who have severe enough restless legs prior to being treated more aggressively that when they get up to have breakfast, they'll prepare it and they'll eat their breakfast on a plate while walking around. So try to imagine that patient going to a desk job and trying to work, because RLS occurs at rest, so they have to move. So unless I've had a few patients who actually get a treadmill desk so that they can walk while they work, but sometimes a standing desk helps. They can, you know, move a little bit, and that could be helpful. But for people who have to be sedentary, like a receptionist or people working, you know, doing a job where they actually have to be tied down to a desk, it can be virtually impossible.
So in your time with the RLS Foundation, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Well, I would say there's two parts to this. I mean, I've been working with the RLS Foundation virtually from when it became an entity. But I also happen to have one of the biggest RLS practices as a personal doctor anywhere. I see success stories kind of every week. You know, it's hard to pick up just one. Typically, the patients who see me have seen several doctors before me, and they are often very much like what I've just described. And with proper therapy, we can get 95 to 98% of these very severely afflicted patients and with patients who have their lives incredibly disruptive, virtually back to normal.
So, if you could send any message to the community about this condition and why it needs to be better understood, what would you say?
What I would say is that the patients with severe RLS, which are, like any disease, a smaller fraction of the restless leg population, which is pretty large. If you figure 2 to 3% of the population, that's as prominent as most of the major diseases, can have very disruptive lives. And there is very good treatment out there, and that patients shouldn't settle for anything other than almost complete relief of their restless legs and the ability to lead normal lives. And actually, I'd like to amplify for a second. Both in Canada and United States, the two drugs that are most commonly used in, I would say, over 90% of patients who are newly diagnosed with restless legs, the brand names are the same in both countries. It's Mirapex and Requip. Generic names are Pramipexole and Ropinirole. They work incredibly well initially, but with time, they actually start to make the RLS dramatically worse, a condition called RLS augmentation. They're augmenting the bad symptoms of RLS. And we know for these drugs that roughly 7 to 8% of patients per year will get this augmentation problem. So by 10 years, you have 70 or 80% of these patients in the augmented restless leg states. And currently, 75% of or more of the patients that the national restless leg specialists like myself see are these patients in RLS augmentation that have the most severe restless legs, typically of, you know, the restless leg population. So my the warning I'd like to give out is that patients who are starting restless leg medication should probably try to avoid those two medications and look for some of the other medications that treat restless legs. And if they do go on those medications, they should stay at extremely low doses, because the higher the dose, the more likely this augmentation problem is to occur.
Thank you.
And, one more thing, and I think it's very important to let the patients know that the RLS Foundation is an excellent resource for RLS patients, because it has the educational resources. It can direct them to a quality center for restless leg treatment. It has webinars that they can be educated by the experts more. So it's just an incredibly good resource for patients who don't know where to go or what to do.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Oh, you're very welcome.
My pleasure. We're going to hear from Julie Brenneiser about Gorlin syndrome. So tell me a little bit about Gorlin syndrome.
Gorlin syndrome is a rare genetic disorder that can manifest itself in every organ system of the body. The most common manifestation and the most burdensome to us is multiple skin cancers called basal cell carcinomas. These can occur in sun-exposed areas and non-sun-exposed areas of the body. And they, for some people, occur by the hundreds every year. We, with Gorlin syndrome, are lacking a tumor suppressor gene, have a defect in the tumor suppressor gene, and that allows these skin cancers to grow.
So,
other common manifestations are jaw cysts, ovarian cysts, large skulls, hydrocephalus. There are a lot of manifestations that we don't have symptoms from, but they exist in our body, like bony abnormalities and extra calcification or things like that.
So, are there any treatments presently available?
For Gorlin, there are no treatments available for Gorlin syndrome as a whole. We can only treat the manifestations, like the basal cell skin cancers. And those treatments vary depending on the age of the individual. Children up to the age of 18 can be treated with, unfortunately, surgery to remove the skin cancers. There are also some creams that can be used, which are kind of uncomfortable for the kids. And there's also another treatment called photodynamic therapy. For adults, there's surgery, there's the creams, there's cryosurgery, which is freezing them off, and there are also oral chemotherapeutic agents in pill form that you can take that for some people are really a miracle drug. Unfortunately, they come with a lot of different side effects that many people find difficult to manage.
So,
and in terms of treating the other manifestations, generally the jaw cysts need to be treated aggressively with surgery, because they are benign cysts, but they are aggressive in their recurrence rate, and so they need to be removed with great precision and diligence because of the high recurrence rate. And the ovarian cysts that some females get need to be surgically removed as well.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for awareness of Gorlin syndrome, what would you say?
The need for awareness of Gorlin syndrome is something that the community needs to hear across a wide spectrum, from individuals with all these different manifestations to the medical professionals, because one of our challenges is that we have such a huge mix of manifestations that people don't know that all these different things are one syndrome. Another important point that I should bring up is that many of us with Gorlin syndrome have little tiny pits in the palms of our hands and the soles of our feet. And they are, if you have those pits, you have the syndrome. So they are something that can help people be identified as having Gorlin syndrome. And that can be helpful to somebody trying to put all the puzzle pieces together. But again, many in the medical community don't recognize the syndrome or don't know about it because these things are not, rare genetic disorders are not covered in medical school in general. So the challenge is to put the pieces together and come up with a diagnosis. And at that point, I would hope that the community would reach out to groups like ours, the Gorlin Syndrome Alliance, because we can help provide support, personal support through Facebook, through personal interactions, and through in-person meetings. We can provide information for medical professionals and for individuals and their caregivers. And we also do a lot of work to support research to find more treatment and ultimately a cure.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Mark Buchfuhrer and Julie Brenneiser. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Hannah Kepka, who will be telling us a little bit about the Campaign Life Coalition. So tell me a little bit about the coalition, how anti-euthanasia can affect a person with a disability.
Can you rephrase the question? What do you mean?
Can you tell me how issues surrounding euthanasia might impact a person with a disability?
I think the most important problem is that these people quite quickly feel pressured to simply choose euthanasia because they're made feel like they're a burden to society, not a sufficient contributor, and so on. And they're being pushed towards making this eugenic decision.
So Can you tell me a little bit about how the coalition would respond in cases such as that?
We have so far conducted petitions to elected officials, urging them to defend the life of people living with disabilities so that they would receive the most advanced and appropriate care that they can, as opposed to be even suggested to that they should perhaps take their own life.
So, do you ever work in cases where a family might feel pressured to end the life of a person with a disability as opposed to...
We know that such situations occur, and one of the most often spoken about test grounds for all these issues are the Netherlands, of course, where euthanasia was introduced quite a long time ago, and we can see the evolution of the widening of the categories included, the categories of people that are eligible for euthanasia, and how indeed families pressure the elderly or the disabled, sometimes both, to end their own lives. We know that people have been so-called euthanized without any demand or consent. So this is not, using the term euthanasia in these situations is a euphemism, of course. These people have been simply killed.
So when you mentioned the Netherlands was sort of a hot spot for these issues, can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I hesitate to go into greater detail because the organization I work for, Campaign Life Coalition, is mostly... dealing with the issues of abortion. So I personally have not been involved significantly in any of the euthanasia-related initiatives. What happened in Campaign Life Coalition, Campaign Life Coalition has been founded in 1978, and in 1998, the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition has separated from Campaign Life. That is, Campaign Life began by being involved in abortion issues, but as the issues of the lack of respect for life were spreading wider and euthanasia started being legalized or talked about maybe in Canada seriously and then eventually legalized, Campaign Life got involved in these issues as well. But once they became really deep and more and more time-consuming, a new organization burgeoned out in a way, budded out, I guess, of Campaign Life Coalition and is concentrating on euthanasia issues, not only in Canada, but around the world. So I would rather not go into greater detail as to what's happening in Holland. There is a very good video on the Campaign Life Coalition website. When you go under more issues, euthanasia, one of the under the tab facts, there is an excellent progression of how these different new categories of patients started being included eligible for euthanasia.
So you've worked in the issues of abortion. Are there ever risks that a child who would be born with a disability might be aborted before they would come to term?
Well, in many places, abortions are done especially for eugenic reasons. That is, if a child has a suspected disability, that child is often aborted. In Holland, we know that there is the euthanasia of infants conducted, and we're... Everybody has heard of what is happening in the United States recently with the debate in the House of Representatives where help for babies surviving abortion the debate on a law that would mandate help for babies surviving abortion is stifled, has been stifled 80 times right now, I think. So very often these are cases of babies who are born with disabilities, and the desire to kill them goes beyond their moment of birth.
So,
and it's often acted upon.
So what message would you send to the community in regards to these children about whether they should be allowed to live and whether they should be aborted or not?
Well, we stand on the position that every life has its intrinsic value and every human being has its dignity. And no matter what are the specific qualities of an individual, the life of that individual merits safeguard and protection by law and the medical community. So taking a life under any pretext is completely objectionable for us.
So what are the next steps for the coalition in terms of their work?
At this point, our work is mostly limited to Canada. However, we work in an international community of pro-life organizations. So as you know, there are federal elections upcoming in Canada, and our main work consists now of identifying pro-life candidates in this election and making them known to the electorate, connecting the voters with those candidates, so that these voters may help in any way they can. We're also working on the international stage. Now, the new thrust of anti-life, anti-family, how should I say this, ideas on the stage of the United Nations is to remove any help specifically available for women and make it available to individuals of any gender, I guess, other than male. And we're working also towards, strengthening the voice on the issue of abortion not being a medical, not being an element of health promotion, right? We're also part of the same activity on the international stage is making sure that any aid that goes to the needy communities and needy individuals goes indeed towards their primary medical needs, life-saving needs, and food needs, employment, and that kind of aspect.
Right.
Unfortunately, there is a very strong push right now to make abortion the key need of any needy community, and we very well know that what they're asking for is help and not killing. So that's what we're working on.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Of course. Campaign Life. The name says it all. That a person with a disability has the right to live and to expect the best out of life should never be a question. Should be a given. We all expect, when we're seeing a new life come into this world, that it will grow up to be potentialed, strong. We all want to hope they're going to change the world. And that, my dear friends, is what we must allow them to do. We must be that supporting voice. The ones who can really be there just to cheer them on. We all have those moments we need that. We all need someone in our corner tearing down the myths that say you're not good enough, you're not strong enough, what have you. But for a person with a disability, that encouragement can make all the difference. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.